Good morning and welcome to Central Standard Friday. I'm Monroe Dodd, here with our regular journey back into time. Our guest today writes that tales and legends are the perfect literary form for a place like Missouri. So many stories here, she writes, are bigger than life and have shaped the image of the American West. Here to share some of the stories with us is Mary Collins Burriel. She's the author of a new book, Forgotten Tales of Missouri. And good morning, Mary.
Hi, thanks again for inviting me.
And thank you for coming. These stories you've collected live on the boundary between fact and legend. The stories can be fantastic or mundane. They can be provable or sometimes otherwise. The sum of them is your book. Let's take the one example, Old Sawbones. His name was Dr. Joseph McDowell. In the 1800s, he helped institute medical education in Missouri. But in those days, preparing a student to become a doctor, just like now, requires certain practice. Students practiced on corpses, and corpses sometimes were hard to come by. Can you pick up the story from there?
Well, in those days, the 1830s, 1820s, later the 1840s, you could go to medical school and become a doctor and never have touched a body. You could just do book studies, which could lead to problems later on during exams. So McDowell decided his students needed to see a real body and do dissection, which a lot of people were against, even into the late 19th century. So he would take his students out, and they would become resurrectionists.
And not in the spiritual form, were they?
No, they would dig up recently deceased folks and haul them back unceremoniously to the med school and spend the evenings doing dissection. You could obtain a body if you got in line, but it had to be an executed criminal. And McDowell had competition from other med schools. So he decided to essentially take matters into his own hands and make it easier for his students.
And he was operating in eastern Missouri?
Yes, he was. He was originally from Kentucky and came up to St. Louis, remained there during the Civil War. He also served for the South and then returned again and did his medical school, reopened it. And I'm not sure if it's the Gratiot Street prison, mm-hmm. was the medical school.
The one that became the infamous Civil War prison.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Now, resurrectionist is a polite way, and there's another term for it, grave robbers.
Grave robbers. it was not a crime to take a body. It was a crime to take a body that had something on it. So you were going to be arrested for stealing the jewelry when you stole the body. But nobody really cared if you stole the body, except the families. And they would go to great lengths. They would put cages that would lock, and they would put those over the graves. They would seal the graves with a concrete type of cover or a slab. But McDowell would pay people to tell him when somebody, particularly poor, had passed away. And they would head out that night and resurrect them.
Basically invading a cemetery.
Absolutely.
And, of course, a cemetery is a place where ghosts, at least in people's minds, lived and all manner of things can occur. So the act of grave robbing became sort of a, I don't know if it's a paranormal act or not, but it certainly became associated with myth and legend.
Well, McDowell himself felt that he had seen ghosts. So I would imagine he felt at home. He was at one point almost lynched by a crowd who came looking for him for stealing a body. And he was standing in the staircase of the med school. He had nowhere to go. He didn't know where to hide. And he, to his dying day, said that he looked around and he saw his mother gesture to him to get onto one of the autopsy tables, which he did. He got onto the autopsy table. He covered himself and remained perfectly still. The people came in, they searched, they looked at the bodies, but they didn't want to get too close. So he was able to pull that off, and he swore it was his mother.
Now, these were reality-based bodies that the students would then go in and saw on.
Yes, absolutely, which is, you know, where he got his nickname, Sawbones.
Old Sawbones.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he also had something to do with a rather famous cave in northeast Missouri.
Yes, he did, and he also had something to do with a rather famous writer. McDowell was a believer in preservation of bodies. He was an experimenter and a researcher, first of all. I mean, he was certainly eccentric, But he was a very, very bright man. He had studied setting up tuberculosis hospitals in caves. He had read about this being successful in Europe. He tried it in Kentucky. In fact, his name is still found in some of the caves scratched on the walls. When he got to Missouri, he purchased a cave up near Hannibal. And unfortunately, the story is not very clear as to whether it was his daughter who died. It was a family member, and he had her encased in a copper tube, and he had the tube placed in the cave in Hannibal. He wanted to study the effects of decomposition. This, of course, everybody knew what was going on, especially a young boy who was absolutely fascinated by this story. His name was Sam Clemens. And Sam and his group would go to the cave, and unfortunately, a lot of the ruffians of the town would unscrew the cap and they would look at the body. And eventually, these stories showed up in The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer.
And in fact, today, the people who are interested in the publicity of Hannibal, Missouri, have a cave you can go visit.
You can still visit McDowell's Cave.
That actually was Dr. McDowell.
Yes, it was. And you do go down the passageway to where the tube, the copper tube, was kept, and they will turn the lights out. So
there is, of course, in Twain literature, that grave-robbing scene. That's
the great grave-robbing scene, yes. And that was probably three or four blocks up the hill from Mark Twain's home. Twain probably knew McDowell, or at least knew of McDowell. He had a distant relative who studied with McDowell. So I'm pretty sure he heard all those stories firsthand.
Now, Missouri was home in the 19th century especially to several utopian communities. One was on the western side of the state, about 100 miles south of here. It got its name from a free-thinking group that called it liberal. It was, you write, an experiment in intellectual community living, and it even banned churches. Tell us about liberal Missouri.
Yes, liberal was founded to be church-free. The devil was not allowed there, as they explained. But they wanted to have a place where people could go and debate the new thing that was coming up, which was science. And how science would affect people, how things like psychology would affect people. Unfortunately, a lot of churches were against this. So the gentleman who started liberal banned churches. It became a go-to place for free thinkers and people who believed in a utopia. There was free love, which shocked everybody. You did not have to be married. One of the theories is that there was also birth control being used there, since the birth rate was much lower in liberal than it would have been in surrounding towns. People were invited to come from anywhere, hold open debate on the soul or physics or atheism. You can imagine how this went over in this part of the world.
In the 1880s.
In the 1880s. Uh-huh. It was shocking. So other groups went over right over the line into Kansas, and they purchased property to set up small towns that encouraged religion. So there was essentially a billboard war, you know, that if you settled in liberal, you were going to hell, and if you went over into Kansas, you were going to hell. So it was a lively place. Eventually, it took another turn and became a home to spiritualists, very, very almost a place where each summer they would have spiritualism revivals, essentially. And spiritualists would flock there, the belief being that you could talk to the dead, that there was a celestial telegraph which mm-hmm. would allow you to talk to the dead, usually through knockings and tappings. Unfortunately, there were some fakes. One was exposed. It became a big newspaper article in the area, and liberal sort of subsided into a slightly more quiet town.
And today it's a town of about 700 people, mm-hmm. and I believe has churches.
It has churches, and people are friendly, and it's a nice place to visit.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd. Today we're talking about some of the lore of the Show Me State. Our guest is Mary Burriel, author of Forgotten Tales of Missouri. One more question about liberal Missouri. There was an interesting thing to the convening place that was invented in the 1880s. It was called Mental Liberty Hall.
Oh, yes, yes. The idea that that was the time when science and religion was starting their big push to see who would win the minds and hearts of the world? The idea that you could go someplace, women included, children included, and hear lectures about, again, free love, you know, the benefit of a life without marriage, certain health practices, you know, certain cures, the idea that doctors were quacks, that if you went to a trained doctor, you had a chance. If you went to a quack, you didn't. These were revolutionary ideas. So the idea of mental health was starting to come to the forefront. And again, it's a fascinating thing that a place like Liberal was, you know, a leader in this.
Now, you mentioned that Liberal Missouri had its competitors. One town was set up right on the outskirts of Liberal, wasn't it? Pedro?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it was, again, to get into Liberal, you needed to have be willing to listen to other people's opinions. On the outskirts, you were going definitely to the devil very quickly. And small towns like Bethel, Missouri would set up. Now, Bethel was another utopian community, but that was a more what we would call today communistic in that term, or communal, where everybody worked for the common good. In Liberal, it was everybody worked at what they needed to work at. The common good was freedom of thought.
A community of ideas.
Community of ideas. And again, you know, to bring in things like the radical thought to the western part of this country was a real step out of the norm.
In your book, Forgotten Tales of Missouri, you have an unsolved murder or two. In fact, unsolved murders never seem to stop happening, despite advances in crime investigation. You write about one that I found particularly haunting. It took place over near the Mississippi River, near Crystal City,
yes,
just south of St. Louis, in the 1870s, and it's the story of Julie LeBlanc.
Yeah.
Would you share that with us?
It's sad. She was a young woman of a French family. Went back to its roots were in France. One day she was waiting. She was going to a dance, and the family thought she was going with the young man who she was sweet on. She didn't return that night. No one gave it much thought because people would often have their parties well into the early morning hours, have breakfast, and then stay over at a friend's home because there was a distance to travel. When she didn't show up the next day, the family went looking for her, and what they found was a boat that had been moored on the edge of the river and the family owned was gone. They saw footprints. They thought maybe she had run off with a lover, but nobody thought this was her personality. Then all of a sudden, a young man from the town who grew up with her came in to the father and said he couldn't stand living in the town any longer. He missed her too much, and he moved to New Orleans. The father, thinking a few weeks after that something was odd, sent private investigators to find him and ask about his daughter, and he had, of course, disappeared, was never heard from again. Several years later, a man was fishing along the river and sees a boat and pulls it to the side, and in the bottom of the boat is a skeleton, and he ran off to get help. You know, forensics being what they were in those days, the best they could do was to take the jewelry that was on the skeleton and bury it along the shore. The news got out. Julie's father thought perhaps this was his daughter. He came down. He looked at the jewelry, which was old French and, as a matter of fact, his daughter's jewelry. Well, they went to exhume her and take her back for burial on the family farm. And when they went to find the body, the river had eaten away the burial site, and she was gone. And they still don't know who the murderer was.
And the guy they were looking for is
never,
as gone as ever.
Probably headed west. Never heard from him again.
Where do you find these stories?
Oh, wow. Old newspapers. Sometimes in something as really good as the WPA guides, you know, they'll hint at something. I mean, you had hundreds of wonderful writers and collectors, including Vance Randolph, going out to talk to people in the 1930s. Now, these were the people who were alive in the 1870s. And we're hearing the stories from people who were born in 1820. So sometimes I'll see that and I'll start to track it back, like Queen Bevis the witch. That's where I first heard her story, and then came to find that there was a really rich tradition of witchcraft in Missouri.
What part of the state was Queen Bevis in?
She was down towards Julie. That whole mid-southeastern part of the state was really fascinating. She married an older man. She was Irish. She actually didn't marry him. It was a common law marriage. And for some reason, her neighbors decided that she was a witch. She didn't pay any attention to it. And unfortunately, it was beyond the time of the witch burnings of Salem. However, there had been a number of witchcraft cases that took place among the Native Americans. And there were some killings connected with those. So the people of that part of the state were very, very sensitive to what witchcraft could do to a community. She was accused of turning men into horses and riding them over to somebody's – and we have the exact names of who she rode and where she went and what party she went to. As I said, she paid really no mind to it and eventually moved back and lived a happy and long life after she was widowed in St. Louis. But Queen Bevis the Witch was certainly an interesting local character.
Reputed to be a witch, but she was never burned.
She was never burned. And she actually donated money to various churches. So there was a love-hate relationship with her.
The part you mentioned, the middle southeastern part, that's the mining district, Potosi.
Yes, you have a lot of French. Ward Doran studied a lot of the work down there. Not so much Vance Randolph, but you get a lot of traditions. We don't really have werewolf traditions, which I kind of expected to find, and I didn't. The loup-garou. So mm-hmm. I didn't really find those. I did. Once in a while, hear a legend of the devil's boat that would fly overhead and pull up the souls who were playing fiddle on the Sabbath.
A couple of times here, Mary, you've mentioned Vance Randolph. Would you tell our listeners about him if they don't know?
Wonderful folklorist who worked down in the Missouri, a little bit of the Oklahoma and the Arkansas Ozarks. He really preserved and highlighted the culture of those areas. He lived with the people. He was a part of the community. This was not someone who kind of went in, spent a couple of months, talked to everybody and left. He spent years and collecting and talking to people about their folk songs and their traditions and their beliefs. He talked about something called a dumb supper, which is an interesting you prepare a supper in total silence and you do it backwards. And then at midnight, you can force a ghost to come to you and tell you something and reveal something. In some cases, it has to be about who you're going to marry. So he talked to people who believed in these things, participated in them, and he did so with a great deal of respect.
Not only in the Ozarks, but in all parts of rural America in the 19th century, we tend to forget in today's age of instant and worldwide and everybody communicating and Facebook and everything that people lived – communities lived fairly isolated lives. And mm-hmm. stories could get going and an influential person could tell a story enough to where the community believed it. And that's kind of where Vance Randolph got these unique stories and where some of yours come from.
Yeah, they're unbroken traditions. They're traditions that in many cases came from Europe. Mm-hmm. Many of our ghost stories have roots there. And I always have people ask me, do you believe in ghosts? Actually, I do. And it's always interesting to me to see the traditions, whether they're ancient Egypt, whether they're Europe, whether they're America, North or South, they remain the same. So people are experiencing something across time and space. I don't know what it is, but they're consistent.
In your book, Forgotten Tales of Missouri, though, every one of these tales, unless I'm mistaken, at least begins with a real person.
Yes. I did a lot of research. Anytime I would come across a name, a place or something, I'd go into census records. I'd see if I could locate, a slave, sometimes, or a free black, and see if that family name existed. So tracking back often revealed stories that were had a lot of truth to them. I'm not sure where maybe some of the folk materials came in. You can look back and you can see who these people were and find out where their story started and how they started.
Now, closer to our own time, you tell the story of Gerald Potter, who was just passing through Missouri, or to be more exact, passing over in a DC-3. What happened that day in 1968?
Yes, that closes out the book because it was one of your most recent. The Pollards had gotten onto a plane in, I think it was Indiana. They were going to a convention. They were with a number of friends who were going to the convention as well. It was a charter flight. The plane took off, and somewhere in mid-flight, they were over Missouri, somewhere near Rolla. Mr. Potter got up to use the men's room. A few minutes later, his wife, not seeing him back, called the stewardess. She was afraid maybe he was ill. When the stewardess went to check, at that point, the pilots also saw an open door light. They went to check, and Mr. Potter was missing. And there were no – the door had was slightly ajar, but the mystery remains as to how and why did this man either, you know, fall or jump from a plane. It's difficult to open those doors, even though they were used for paratroops. It's difficult for a door to be opened and nobody in the plane to really notice it. You know, chances are it was a freak accident. Some people did say they felt a slight bump. But still, it's not the largest plane in the world. And to have somebody just sort of lean on a door, go out, you know, he was never found, of course. It still remains a mystery. It's still debated on pilots' websites and blogs. It's kind of interesting to follow it.
These are the old workhorse DC-3s, yeah. Couple propellers. They go back, date back to the 1930s in the design.
They were tough, well-maintained airplanes. So, leaning on that door doesn't just pop it open, mm-hmm. You know, and chances are you lean on a door, it pops open, the door doesn't shut. So it's still a really great aviation mystery.
And it is for a fact that Gerald Potter was on the plane when the plane departed from the Midwest.
He was not there at mid-flight. He said hello to friends and chatted with them on his way down the aisle to the men's room. And that was the last anybody saw of him.
In preparation for this show, I looked at one of the websites yesterday with all the doubters and the questioners about that. It goes back and forth and back and forth. Mm-hmm. But one thing that it's like a D.B. Cooper, except he didn't take a bunch of money with it.
No, he wasn't meaning to. That was the point. I think he wanted to go to the convention. Everybody said he was a very happy, well-adjusted man. So it wasn't a case of suicide. People say, you know, as I said, there was a light that came on.
In the cockpit.
In the cockpit. What's interesting is one of the pilots, when I started to trace the story back, was a Cuban refugee. Mm-hmm. He had an interesting story. He was in Cuba. He had been in the Air Force, and he was essentially kidnapped by people who wanted to get out of Cuba and made to fly to the United States.
In the wake of Castro.
Mm-hmm. And when he got to the United States, he decided there was no way he was going back to Cuba. So he stayed here and became a commercial pilot. Mm-hmm. And it was just kind of interesting to me that he had some real interesting experiences through his life.
And that departure from Cuba was less than a decade before this incident over Rolla, Missouri.
I probably wouldn't get on a plane with this gentleman, but
There was the question also of had he been murdered, but that kind of violence would have probably gotten more attention than
again, what are you looking at? 30 feet, 40 feet in an aluminum tube, you know, and nobody, it seemed, got up from their seat, you know. So, it's still odd.
That's a wild story. Just one of the many you've collected in Forgotten Stories of Missouri. Our guest today is Mary Collins Burriel. That's her book, Forgotten Stories of Missouri. And we'll be back after the bottom of the hour. If you have a story, forgotten or not, of Missouri, give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Welcome back to Central Standard Friday. I'm Monroe Dodd. We're talking with Mary Collins Burriel about her book, Forgotten Tales of Missouri. If you have your own Missouri tale or have a question about any of the ones we've discussed or a comment, call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. FrankieAndJohnny.org. Now, one of the tales you tell, Mary, in the book Forgotten Tales of Missouri is about Frankie and Johnny, a traditional song about cheating at love. Now, this song has been sung by scads of artists from Lead Belly to Mae West to Lena Horne to Pete Seeger, from Van Morrison to Stevie Wonder. The story it tells could have been invented, but it wasn't invented. In fact, it has deep roots in turn-of-the-century Missouri. As you write, there was a real-life Frankie who had a boyfriend who'd done her wrong.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think the best stories are true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they get embroidered, but that's okay. Dig down and find its heart. Frankie Baker was a woman of relatively loose morals who worked in what we would call the Tenderloin District of St. Louis. And she fell in love with Albert, who was a sporting man and used to find work for all the girls. She doted on him. She was quite popular in the community. She was known as a woman with a temper, but she liked good things, and she was a hard worker. She had an apartment that she rented, and Albert would eventually move in with her. He was only 17. He was a couple of years younger than Frankie. She did find him with another woman, and they were at a dance. According to one of the stories, the couple had just won a cakewalk dance, and Frankie came in and told Albert to, you know, get home, and he ignored her. She went home, and the stories start to, you know, divert into different areas a little bit. He came home, clearly was starting to have an argument with Frankie that night early in the morning. He jumped at her. She took out a knife and stabbed him. Police came. He died. And she was brought up on charges of murder. The truth is a little bit different, and the songs certainly take it off. They changed his name to Johnny a couple of not long after the murder. It was only about 2 weeks. You start to hear songs in the local taverns about Frankie and Johnny. Actually, it was Frankie and Albert to begin with, but Albert's father was so upset, he went to the singers and said, you can't do this. My son just died. So they changed it to Albert.
To Johnny.
From Albert. Frankie was, again, brought up on charges and found innocent. It was self-defense. Albert was known to have a bad temper as well. She got out on Friday the 13th, and she said it was the luckiest day of her life because they gave her her knife and her gun back. She did own a gun. Well, she became infamous from this murder, and the tune really took off. So people knew her, and she continued working in St. Louis, but found that notoriety was too much for her to take. She had read about roses, and she wanted to stay in a place, you know, where there were roses. So she went out to California and then up to Oregon. So she went between the two states. She had homes in them. She went back to her work as a working girl, but she also worked in hotels. Eventually, when Mae West and there was another movie that came out, was She Done Him Wrong, and then another one, Frankie decided to sue the movie studios because she felt they were portraying her wrongly. She did. She was an African-American woman who had been a prostitute, and she didn't have a chance of a fair trial. She had some good lawyers, but they knew there wasn't any kind of a chance. As a matter of fact, people perjured themselves on the stand to say that they had never heard the song referred to. You know, Frankie, it was about somebody else. It was another murder somewhere else. Frankie lived out her life destitute and eventually died in a mental institution.
The song lives on, and not only that, but also the legend lives on in the mural in the Capitol Lounge in Jefferson City that Thomas Hart Benton drew.
And it's a beauty. It really is. And he, from what I understand, spoke to people who were familiar with the actual shooting.
He has three vignettes from Missouri legend. One is Jesse James, one is Huck Finn and Jim, and one is Frankie and Johnny.
Yep.
Thanks very much. We have a caller. Let's go to Mary in South Kansas City. Mary, welcome to Central Standard Friday.
I am enjoying this show so much. I was calling maybe to ask the guest. I read a book called White Slaves, and ostensibly this is a true story. about a farmer in Carthage, Missouri. This was during, it was during slavery time.
Mm-hmm.
And his daughter had a baby by one of her father's friends. Well, the times being what they were, you know, this was horrible. Here's this baby born out of wedlock. So the father gave the baby to a slave woman to raise as her own.
Mm-hmm.
And that child was raised into adulthood as a slave, little blonde-haired, blue-eyed boy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering if you are familiar with this story. All I remember is the name of the book.
I'm not familiar with the book, but I am familiar with stories like that. Certainly in Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
One took place in St. Louis, and we'll get back to that in a second. The idea that, of course, a blonde-haired child would be raised as a slave, you know,
mm-hmm.
all it took was, unfortunately, that one drop of blood, and nobody could prove differently. In St. Louis, there was a story, and it's true, it took place around the 1820s. It was a mayor, Francis Darby, I believe was his last name.
Uh-huh.
And he walked out. He knew an African-American woman. She had been she was a slave. And
uh-huh.
He knew her, and she was raising this little girl who, you know, apparently was blonde and blue-eyed. And he asked her, and the woman had found a young woman dying from cholera. And
mm-hmm.
the woman begged her to take the child. I mean, the woman was dying on the street. So the woman in St. Louis took the child and raised her. And after the Civil War, you had the carpetbaggers coming in. And they, at least one group, wanted to take this child from this African-American woman, saying, you know, I'll take her and raise her. She belongs, of course, in a white family. And this woman went to Darby, and she sued to keep this child. And she won.
Wow.
Yeah, she won.
Yeah.
She eventually voluntarily gave up the child to the nuns in St. Louis to be raised because she wanted the little girl to have more than she could give her.
Yes.
But mm-hmm. she said, I'm raising this girl, and I promised her mother I would. So back off. And she won.
Mary, did you say this story that you read was in a book?
Yes. The book was called White Slaves, and it was set in Carthage, Missouri.
Okay. I'll have to check it out. Thank you very much.
And I wanted to ask you one more question. I am a real big history buff.
Great.
There is allegedly a mansion, well, it was considered a mansion then, on Paseo, like between 11th and 12th.
Mm-hmm.
And now the rumor that I had heard was that this home was owned by, I think, Al Capone.
I think Al Capone did not show up in the Kansas City area. He spent a lot of his time, most of his time in Chicago. And down
right.
in Miami Beach.
Oh, I wish I knew the exact address of that place.
Yeah, we could look it up in a city directory. There were plenty of mobsters in Kansas City in the 20th
oh, yeah.
century. I'm not
right.
sure Al Capone got it, but it's an interesting question. Mary, thanks very much for your call. And let's move on to the book Forgotten Stories of Missouri. Our guest is Mary Collins Barile. And one of the forgotten stories is about a guy who's not forgotten at all. His name is Scott Joplin. He was from St. Louis and from Sedalia, and he was the king of ragtime music. I can remember in the 1970s when his opera, Tremonisha, was first stage, although Joplin died in 1917, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But there was another opera that this famed precursor of a lot of modern music mm-hmm. Did, based on a visit to the White House. Can you tell us about that opera and why we don't hear it?
We don't hear it because it's lost. Unfortunately, Joplin struggled very hard during his life. We'll talk about him. The opera was called A Guest of Honor, and it was about a visit of Booker T. Washington to Teddy Roosevelt's White House. Now, Roosevelt often had African-American friends, but this particular visit caught the eye of the newspaper because of Booker T. Washington's stature. and became, of course, a how dare a white president allow an African-American to dine with him. Joplin was fascinated by it, turned it into an opera. Supposedly, some of the tunes still exist in a few of Joplin's rags and some of his compositions, but we're really not sure. He did a lot of research. He wrote the opera. He did not have his operas. It was produced. We don't know anything about it. He took the opera on tour.
Mm-hmm.
But that, along with some of his music, was in a trunk. And Joplin, his troupe was at a hotel. They couldn't pay their fee. Their money had been stolen by an unscrupulous manager. So the hotel owner, several different versions of the tale, took the trunk and said, well, I'll keep it until you can pay me. They never got back to it. Thus, we've lost a great deal of Joplin's work.
And precious few references even to this work.
Very few. There are some advertisements in newspapers that indicate he performed it probably in Missouri, Illinois, probably a few places there. We're not sure if it got up to Iowa. There was a sort of a theatrical trail that they would follow when this trunk disappeared. Supposedly it disappeared in Pittsburgh. Everybody looked, of course, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Chances are it was Pittsburgh, Kansas.
Mm. And of course, he went on. It was after he had passed away that his music was discovered.
Yes, and he won a Pulitzer.
The 1970s or 80s.
Yeah.
He is now called the King of Ragtime, and
right.
This is the forerunner of jazz, which is the forerunner of rock and roll and a lot of popular.
Missouri is very lucky. I mean, they have we have here Scott Joplin, John Blind Boone, who worked a little bit, pretty much contemporary with Joplin. I mean, there was overlap, and Boone really did some early ragtime, and of course, ragtime. Do we have it's a Missouri style. We always talk about the Missouri blues. Actually, ragtime is probably even more so. And they've both followed the same tracks in from Texas and up from the South. And they coalesced here and gave a very, very rich musical legacy to this country.
And in Scott Joplin's case, by way of Sedalia, you have so many stories in your book that are based on fact, then they tend to be eccentrics that you're writing about, and the legend creeps in, and it's not always provable which is which. You must have left some on the cutting room floor.
Oh, wow. I have, it was hard. I tried to go with legends that are not done over and over again. One I did was Patience Worth.
Mm-hmm.
Which was a fascinating example of whatever you want to call it. Nobody's really sure. Pearl Curran in the 1920s in St. Louis started to channel a character, a woman she called Patience Worth, who was supposed to be from England in the 17th century. And Patience dictated to Pearl over a number of years novels and books and poems and plays. I've read parts of them. Some I've read in whole. Some of them are terrible. Some of them are very interesting. So whatever was happening here, whether it was one theory is that, Curran had a different, for lack of a better description, a split personality, and one was Patience Worth and one was Pearl Curran. And yet her use of language is very interesting. I often wonder, where did she learn it? She does hit the 17th century pretty well. But I include that because we have Mark Twain coming back in there. Pearl's friend was a newspaper woman and a personality. She was married to a wealthy man in St. Louis. I believe there's a water lily named after her, as a matter of fact. She clearly didn't like the attention Pearl Curran received with Patience. So she went off and she found a friend who was also a medium, and they did the Ouija board thing. And ended up with Mark Twain appearing. And Mark, as she called him, dictated a very dreadful novel called Jap Heron to her. And she published that book as dictated from the beyond by Mark Twain. The kind of the joke was that, Sam's friends, Sam Clemens, called him Sam. I mean, there would probably be no way he would be showing up as Mark Twain. But that being said, it was also bad, and the critics said that if that's the best he could do in the next world, we're all in trouble.
I think anybody who writes wishes they could channel Mark Twain or Willa Cather
for five minutes.
Yeah. Might take me several hours, but I wish it would happen. You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd, here with Mary Bareil, who's sharing with us some stories from her book, Forgotten Tales of Missouri. If you have your own story or a question or a comment, join us by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Mary Bareil, you tell us about the day that the Mississippi River ran backward, back in 1812, was it?
Oh, yes, the great New Madrid earthquakes. In fact, this is the bicentennial of the New Madrid earthquakes. They actually started in late part of the year, and they went on for several years. It was the largest earthquake that we know of on the North American continent during that has been reported. You ended up with Real Foot Lake being created, and the Mississippi, because the earth was thrown up so high and the plates, you know, shoved the land up, the river did run backwards. We don't know how many thousands of people died, probably fewer than would certainly than unfortunately would have today, because it was a very sparsely populated area. The people who were lost were the people on the flatboats, you know, because we don't have any record of them. As a matter of fact, one of Teddy Roosevelt's distant relatives, Nicholas Roosevelt, was running one of the first steamboats up the river and was present with his wife, who was pregnant, during the New Madrid quakes, and they left some spectacular descriptions of the sand spouts and the oil spouts and, you know, entire Native American villages just being swallowed up.
Now, their boat was not swallowed up, I take it.
No, they made it. They made it all the way up to St. Louis. It was remarkable on many accounts. You know, a woman on board, a steam engine heading up the river, and an earthquake. And a pregnancy. I mean, you know.
And the river is sloshing northward again.
They tied up at an island one night because one of the descriptions of the New Madrid was this constant lightning, which apparently occurs during major earthquakes, but it was just constant. They tied up at an island during the night. They felt bumping. And at daylight, the island was gone. So, you know, it was just luck.
The New Madrid earthquake. Let's go to the callers. Bill in Overland Park. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. My grandfather was, to the chagrin of his family in Charleston, was a member of the Lou Dockstader Minstrel Group. And they discovered Al Jolson, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And he was supposed to have met my grandmother here in Kansas City. And there aren't many records of minstrel troops left. And if you do find pictures, they're all in blackface, so you can't identify anybody.
Right.
So I'm wondering if you happen to know if the Lou Dockstader Minstrels would have appeared in Kansas City, and if so, where?
Off the top of my head, I have no idea. I would guess they probably did. Variety. You can get the microfilm, or microforms, I'm not sure. You can borrow it through any of the libraries here. The State Historical Society and University of Missouri owns copies. And Variety would publish where all the minstrel shows, where all the traveling performers were going. And each year they would put out big long lists of who's appearing at what theater when. I might start with that, and of course I would start with the newspapers of that time to see who was appearing.
Excellent. Thank you very much for your help.
Oh, you're welcome. Good luck in your search.
Thank you. Bye.
Now let's go to Ron in Kansas City. Good morning, Ron.
Hello there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I grew up in a small town along the Missouri River. It's actually Norborn, Missouri. And as a kid, my folks used to talk about a guy by the name of Seldom Seen. That's the name he went by. And it was kind of a ghost story, sort of. I guess as a kid, it was a sort of a mystery. But I'm just wondering if there's any truth to this Seldom Seen character or if your guest has ever heard of this person.
That is a wonderful name. There were a number of hermits who lived in Missouri. They tended to live in caves. You know, today we'd be sort of taking them to a local hospital for treatment. Very often they had emotional issues or mental issues. But they did, I mean, I've read a number of occurrences of, and the townspeople would very often leave food for these men, less often women, you know, check in on them once in a while. Sometimes they'd have one or two friends. So that seldom seen sounds to me so much like a folk story that as soon as I get out of here, I'm heading right back to the library and seeing what I can track down. But I'm not familiar with that individual, but I wouldn't doubt he existed.
Okay, well, I appreciate the call, and I've enjoyed the program very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ron. Let's go now to Phil in Kansas City. Good morning, Phil.
Hey, good morning. I'm really enjoying the show also. I was wondering if your guest had heard of the glowing tombstone in Leighton, Missouri.
Oh, that's one.
No?
This is great.
No.
I love this show.
She's got another volume coming up.
Yes, right. Volume 2 will be out next year. I love getting the stories. Tell me about the glowing tombstone.
Well, when I was in college in the mid-60s at Warrensburg, I had a fraternity brother who was from Leighton, Missouri, and there was a story, and it's actually true. We went out, and there's a cemetery outside of Leighton, and at night, if very little stars, the moon's not out, up in the cemetery there is a tombstone that glows, but you can't see it when you get in the tombstone. You can see it from down below from the road, and a bunch of us went out there, and we would have two or three guys up in the cemetery and two or three guys down on the road yelling up, you know, go left, go back, go right, and you could see it. And I think they think it's maybe some of the stone that maybe keeps the light in during
right.
the day, but
mm-hmm.
they had even turned the lights off. They were thinking maybe, well, it was a reflection from the lights of town, but they had tried that years before and turned all the lights off, and it still glowed. And supposedly, and I can't remember, you know, sometimes you think, well, I did that. Now I was there, and we. And during the time looking, I was down on the road, and I was also up in the cemetery. And supposedly there was a little boy that died, and this is what sounds weird. His name was Johnny Glow, and he died like when he was 2 years old. And his headstone is there, and this light is close to that, but you can't really narrow it down to his tombstone, because when you're up in the cemetery, you cannot see it, and you cannot get. Exactly where the tombstone is, but I remember it was a glowing tombstone, and it's a cemetery just outside of Leighton, Missouri.
Well, I am going to have to go find that this summer.
Yeah,
absolutely. It's like the Joplin spook lights. I'm sorry.
Leighton is in Johnson County, Missouri.
Yes, I believe it is just south of Warrensburg.
Okay,
just
okay.
2 miles. And I will let you go. And thank you very
well,
much.
Thank
Again,
you
I,
for
I'm
the
really
story.
I'm really enjoying this show.
Okay.
Thank you, Phil. Boys and young men going out into cemeteries to see paranormal things, Mark Twain or the guys in Warrensburg, it's funny.
You often get crying angel tombstones. You get witch balls. They're usually those big black spheres. For some reason, they're associated with something not so pleasant. So, graveyards are a great place to find stories.
And speaking of seldom seen, let's go to Mike in Kansas City. Good morning, Mike.
Yes, I just wanted to mention, back in, I don't know, in Kansas City, in maybe in the 60s, there was a criminal named Seldom Seen. I can't remember, I'm sure he had a last name, but he just went by the name Seldom Seen. And I remember that he was seen down by the river with a suitcase that disappeared. And so anyway,
okay.
if you look up things under names seldom seen related to Kansas City, you might find this guy's name.
Well, I am looking forward to that because
okay.
that's a story. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I may be stretching it a little bit, my brain and my memory, but I believe in the Robert Altman movie Kansas City, Harry Belafonte played a shady character named Seldom Seen. So the name may have been shared by a lot of things, including in, along the river in Norbourne, Missouri, along the river here, too. That's all the time we have for today's show. Our guest has been Mary Collins Barile, author of Forgotten Tales of Missouri. Mary, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, this was a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Now, for more information on our guests and upcoming shows, visit our website, kcur.org. Central Standard Friday was produced today by Andrea Salenzi. Our announcer was Kim Noble. I'm Monroe Dodd. Thanks for joining us, and enjoy your weekend.